Happy Friday, everybody. It is the Information's 411, a podcast brought to you by the reporting team at The Information. We're a new site that hopefully you know and love that covers the tech industry and the broader business world. I'm Corey Weinberg. I'm filling in for your usual host, Tom Dertan, this week. I am also a reporter at The Information. And we have a great show lined up for you this week. We wanted to continue the conversation on race and tech. We're releasing this episode, of course, on Juneteenth, which marks the end of slavery in the U.S. So all of the Information's coverage today will exclusively feature African Americans. We want to continue to bring more visibility to Black voices in technology and investing. And we're going to center this episode around policy change. How can tech companies and tech products help create a more just system of laws in this country? And we're going to bring you two interviews. First, we talk to Catherine Bracey. She is a former political organizer for Barack Obama, who now leads an Oakland-based group called the Tech Equity Collaborative. I talked to her about why tech companies aren't influencing key policy on the local and state level that affects economic and racial inequality. And then we'll hear from Nikidra Robinson, who runs a Baltimore-based nonprofit called Black Girls Vote, which used tools like Instagram and Zoom to boost civic engagement in a recent local election. So it's a packed show. It's from coast to coast, from Oakland to Baltimore. Let's get into it. Catherine Bracey is the executive director of the Tech Equity Collaborative, an Oakland-based advocacy group that tries to rally tech workers around state, regional, and local policy issues like housing and homelessness. Catherine, thanks for being with us. You started the Tech Equity Collaborative in 2016. Why? What's your goal?
Well, I was inspired by Uber's announcement that they were buying an old Sears department store in downtown Oakland and moving about 2,500 jobs there. And the community reacted very negatively to that. And I was paying attention because I happened to live across the street from that building. So I was interested in who my new neighbors were going to be. But my professional background is at the intersection of technology and civics. And so I was really interested in this dynamic between what was at the time the most valuable privately held company in the world and what were going to be their potential new neighbors in downtown Oakland, a community where the median income is about $25,000 a year. And it occurred to me that, you know, there was something had gone really wrong with our economy when, that company, such a rich company, could announce they're bringing thousands of really good jobs to a place that has been underinvested in for decades and the community would not see value in that. So I started thinking a lot about how we had gotten to that point, but more importantly, what would it take to get us out? What would need to change in order for a large tech company to announce they're moving to a place like downtown Oakland and for the community to see value in that for them? And that became sort of the foundational question that Tech Equity was built on. How do we create the conditions so that as tech grows, everyone benefits from that growth, particularly communities that are most vulnerable and have been kind of most victimized by economic development policies of the past?
And you wrote an op-ed last week saying the headline was "Tech Companies, It's Time to Show That Black Lives Really Matter to You." And one issue that you're trying to tackle with Tech Equity Collaborative, and one of the issues that you write about in this piece, is property tax reform in California, specifically the 1970s law passed with anti-tax fervor pre-Reagan, you know, called Prop 13. Why is this issue connected to racial justice, you know, specifically places like Oakland where you live?
Well, I mean, I think it's first important to talk about why we decided that working on these structural issues was the way to achieve our broader mission. We initially thought we could just work on sort of corporate decision making and corporate social responsibility policies, and companies are going to, you know, do more in the community and things will get better. And it became pretty clear pretty quickly that the problem was actually much deeper And that if we were going to get to a place where, you know, as tech companies move in, that growth is driving opportunity for everybody, we were going to have to address the structural, underlying structural issues that were causing the opposite to happen, that when tech companies moved in, it was driving displacement and inequality. And those issues, you know, those are seeds that were planted decades ago.
A revolution against taxes and government.
As you mentioned, Prop 13 is really one of the fundamental root causes of a lot of why California is so unequal right now. For those who don't know, Prop 13, ballot initiative passed in the late 70s at the kind of apex of the, or really kind of a vanguard of the anti-tax supply side trickle down theories that became popular when Reagan became president.
Prop 13, like former Governor Ronald Reagan, reassured voters that it wouldn't spell disaster.
A loss of revenue over any period of time is not, it will not happen unless the people bury that $7 billion in a tin can in the backyard.
It restricted property taxes to the value of the property when it was purchased, instead of, as is done in just about every other state in the country, pegging property taxes to the actual current market value of the property. And what this has done is robbed the state of hundreds of billions of dollars over the last 40 years. Corporately owned land in California is being assessed for property tax value at the same rate it was assessed at in 1978. We all know property taxes go to the counties and to special districts like school districts. That's how public schools are funded. And as we have lost hundreds of billions of dollars in funding for public schools and things that counties administer, like public health, which, you know, is an important thing to have fully funded in the middle of a pandemic, affordable housing, mental health services, all these things that we see as sort of manifesting as social dysfunction on the street right now, are things that property taxes go to fund. I believe it's the single most important policy issue in California right now. And if we don't fix it, then we are going to continue to see the fifth largest economy in the world have the highest poverty rate in the country. In terms of racial equity, I mean, it's really hard to disentangle racial equity from economic equity. Structural racism is built into all of these decisions, how we spend money, who we collect money from. Obviously, starving public schools in California of the necessary funding has had a disproportionate negative impact on Black communities. When we don't fully fund social services, that has a disproportionate impact on Black communities. So it definitely is a not just an economic equity issue, but a racial equity issue. You know, tech didn't create those structural issues. We were going to have to engage the tech community on fixing those structural issues. And it was important to engage tech, one, because tech was not at the table, and that was driving a really toxic civic dynamic. But also, tech has a lot of political clout, not just the companies, but the individual people who work at tech companies. And, you know, by and large, they were not using that political clout to exert influence on local issues. And we saw an opportunity to really create a political constituency that could advocate for these kinds of policies.
And what kind of fixes are you shooting for? This is obviously a polarizing political issue in California, in part because, you know, this sort of any kind of change to this law would, you know, potentially be the kind of thing that homeowners, that commercial property owners all would be defensive about, potentially facing higher taxes. How are you seeking change on this topic?
Yeah, so the ballot initiative, which is qualified for the November ballot, so if you are registered to vote in California, you'll be voting on this. It actually just removes the Prop 13 protections for commercial and industrial properties that are worth more than $3 million. And we're talking about, you know, huge corporate landowners like Disney and Chevron, big commercially zoned properties. So that would raise about $10 to $12 billion a year. 40% of it would go to public education. It's also importantly, you know, a benefit for new companies. So tech companies should be their issue. You know, we have tech companies who are leasing office space in San Francisco, paying the highest office rents in the world. And instead of their landlords having to pay more in property taxes, to account for that new value that's been created by the tech companies that are building products that, you know, are leasing office space in their buildings, they're pocketing all that profit. So if I'm a tech founder And I'm paying, we did one estimate that says, you know, something like 40% of venture capital dollars in San Francisco go to landlords. That much money to corporate landowners. And then on the back end, I'm getting blamed for everything that's wrong in San Francisco. I'd be really pissed. So we really think that this is the tech community's issue as much as it is anybody else's issue. And we're hoping that they will support the campaign.
And this was one of the issues you brought up in your piece last week. You know, you wrote that your organization has succeeded in rallying tech workers around these some of these policy issues like tenant protections. But you wrote, and I quote, "Convincing tech companies to step up has been a different story. They have largely opted to stay on the sidelines." Why has it so hard, been so difficult to get the actual companies to get involved in some of these policy issues that touch on sort of big structural changes in California?
My assumption is that it has a lot, they just don't want to take the risk, right? And in any political issue, there are going to be people who are for it and people who are against it. And, you know, they don't want to piss off the wrong people. The charitable assessment is that they don't really see this as the thing that they need to step out on. Like, it's not an issue that's central to the product or business, you know? I mean, there are tech companies we have seen are interested in getting involved in politics when it's something that really is, you know, directly tied to their bottom line, as we see companies like Lyft and DoorDash putting tens of millions of dollars into a ballot initiative that will be on the November ballot to protect their, you know, employee or lack thereof model of employment for their drivers. So it's not that they're not willing to get engaged when it's in their direct economic interest, but they don't see this as in their direct economic interest. And that's sort of what I find slightly offensive, is that it's, you know, they're willing to make a PR statement about Black lives, but they aren't, it doesn't occur to them that that is central enough to who they are as a company to really do the work to solve racial equity issues. And I'd like them to see it that way.
Catherine Bracey, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Next, we're going to look at four important words: get out the vote. I spent some time in recent weeks reporting on how tech startups and tech giants were looking to drive up voter turnout in hopes that it would lead to healthier democracies. It's particularly important during a pandemic when political campaigners won't be knocking on many doors or standing with clipboards on sidewalks trying to register voters. But researchers have shown that text message campaigns, voter turnout drives on Facebook, and digital advertising haven't done much to increase the number of voters in past elections. Political scientists, however, are excited by the prospect that people are more likely to vote if they feel more socially connected to the election. That brings us to an organization called Black Girls Vote, based in Baltimore. Nikita Robinson runs that group. She started it after Freddie Gray's death sparked protests around that city. I'm speaking now with Nikedra Robinson. Nikedra, thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, Corey. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about voting.
Tell me just briefly about your organization and how you got it started.
Black Girls Vote, we are about engaging, educating, and empowering Black women to be involved in the political process, particularly 18 to 25-year-olds. We know that Black women are loyal voters, but we also want to make sure that Black women are getting policy in exchange for our vote. And more importantly, that our young people know the importance of voting and teach them about policy. In some cases, voter turnout is low. And when we talk about the local elections, that really does matter. It's those local elections that determine what day of the week or how many times our trash is being picked up, or if there are going to be streetlights in our neighborhood, all those things that impact our day-to-day lives.
Tell me about your idea this year.
A year ago, 6 months ago, none of us would have thought we would be living in the middle of a pandemic. But, you know, life goes on, civic engagement goes on, voting still has to continue. It was very evident that we would be voting by mail when the governor announced it, but folks didn't get the opportunity. Majority of us would be voting by mail. in some polling locations. You may have gone to a polling location. It may have been festive, activities going on. But when you're at home and in the middle of a quarantine, you no longer have that same experience. People wanted, like, I didn't get my I voted sticker. And to some, you know, that's something they take pride in. We launched a campaign called Party at the Mailbox. It's literally your mailbox becomes your ballot box. The Party at the Mailbox idea was, hey, we're going to bring the party to you. So we designed, you know, these customized boxes. And in these customized boxes, we had lots of goodies in them. More importantly, we had education. We wanted to let people know their polling locations, let them know their deadlines. These are the resources. These are the things that are available. And we brought the party. We had balloons in there. We had blowhorns. We had confetti. Even though we would not be at the polling locations that night, we did our virtual election party. It was Baltimore's biggest election night party, which was virtual. So we had to, you know, implement technology. We know that, hey, you know, to see my mother zooming, who had never zoomed before. Now, this is her second time, but the fact that my mom now knows how to zoom is beyond me. And I'm like, she's like, yeah, just send me the Zoom. Who's someone who was scared of technology, right? Vote by mail worked for us in the efforts that we did in Baltimore. Here, we had roughly about 50% voter turnout. It was the highest since 1987 in a Democratic primary that the turnout was this high. Part of the Mailbox is about community, and it's about involving community. It's not about getting a box. It's about the experience that comes with the box and making sure that people are engaged and excited about this election and you feel that you are part of a greater community.
Nike Robinson, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No, Corey, thank you so much for having me. It's so honored to be here, and I can't wait to come back. You're going to invite me back, right?
That's our show today. Special thanks to Nikita Robinson and Catherine Bracey for joining me. This episode was produced by Ariella Markowitz, and I'm very interested in your feedback this week. You can find me on Twitter at Corey Weinberg or email Corey@theinformation.com. That's Corey without an E. And Tom Dotan will be back next week, so we'll see you then.